After Hurricane Irma, we're pausing to take a breath and think about the consequences of the giant storm. Welcome to our Reporters Roundtable. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sessingham. We're starting something new on Florida Matters. Once a month, we're going to gather together some experienced reporters from around the state for perspective on the important news happening in Florida. Joining me today in studio, Tamara Lush, correspondent with the Associated Press. Joining us from Miami, Kate Stein, a reporter with NPR member station WLRN. And on the phone from Sebring, Ramona Washington, executive editor of the Highlands News Sun. One of the most horrifying stories to come out of the hurricane was when 8 elderly people died in a nursing home in South Florida after the air conditioning went out, and 3 more of the residents have died since. And those deaths have also been attributed to the sweltering heat that they endured there. Kate Stein, you've been covering this. Do we know more about exactly how this was allowed to happen?
Well, we've learned a lot in the past week or so since the initial deaths occurred. This nursing home where a lot of patients, their temperatures were recorded close to 110 degrees in some cases. This nursing home was right across the street from a hospital, one of the larger regional medical centers in Hollywood. And amid all the questions that have been raised about the power generators and, you know, why didn't utility providers get this nursing home back online sooner? Amid all of those questions, I think the biggest one still is why didn't nursing home administrators call 911 instead of trying? They've said they tried Governor Rick Scott's cell phone a number of times. You know, they reached out to the Agency for Healthcare Administration, I believe. But the biggest question I think that we are still awaiting an answer to is why not just call 911 or walk across the street?
Yeah. So were there national regulations guiding nursing homes that weren't followed or that nursing homes in Florida don't have to follow?
Well, the national regulations as far as generators go are non-existent right now. In November, as a result of Hurricane Katrina, actually, because of some of what we saw in terms of patients becoming ill or dying in nursing homes after that storm knocked out power, in November, there are federal regulations that are going to go into effect that will require nursing homes to have a backup source of power to keep temperatures in a comfortable range, which is, I think, defined as between 71 and 81 degrees. But those regulations don't require a generator specifically to power the air conditioning. And so nursing homes are going to be able to continue to use things like spot coolers or ice water to try to keep patients cool and comfortable should they lose power. And that's what the nursing home staff at this nursing home in Hollywood were attempting to do for their patients. They didn't have a generator to power their air conditioning system, but they were trying to keep them cool, in some cases actually stripping them down so that they were just not wearing any clothes. And so the federal regulations probably won't have that much of an effect on these patients in a situation like this. But what is going to potentially have a pretty significant effect is the state regulations, because in the aftermath of what's happened at this nursing home in Hollywood, Governor Scott and people at the Agency for Healthcare Administration, they're now pushing a rule that would require nursing homes to have generators to power their air conditioning system, which is something that we have not had before. There was never a requirement for generators specifically. And so that's one big change on the state level that would hopefully kind of intensify the requirements that are also going into effect on the federal level.
So there's a time limit on this, right? They want this done within 60 days. And I imagine there's some pushback from nursing homes or assisted living facilities about those new rules.
Yeah, there was a kind of a consortium of nursing home providers, and they met and they talked about this new regulation. And the consensus, I think, was that it's a good idea for patient safety, but it's going to be really, really hard. You know, it takes a while to install a generator. And also, these are expensive. I mean, they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I guess the overall consensus is that it's a good idea, but executing it as the governor is hoping it will be executed in this short 2-month time span is going to be pretty difficult.
And Governor Rick Scott did come forward with that emergency order right after this. And Tamara Lush, before, during, and after the hurricane, Governor Scott was very accessible. He was all over the state. He was all over the TV. He wanted to make sure people knew that the state's resources were going into dealing with this crisis. What's the feeling about how Governor Rick Scott performed during Hurricane Irma?
I think the overall feeling is that he performed pretty well. Everybody that I've talked to was really impressed at what they saw from him during news conferences, at how strong and capable he seemed in the face of what would be a tragedy across the state.
Do you think this is going to give him a little political ammunition coming up if he does eye the Senate seat coming up?
I would suspect so. I think it made the governor seem more in tune with a variety of people. I think it gave a different perspective on the governor that we haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. And people were comparing it to President George W. Bush flying over Katrina and looking down. And I guess Governor Scott really wanted to avoid any kind of similarity there.
Sure. And I think he also had Jeb Bush. He was known for being a pretty good governor during hurricanes. And I think that he had, you know, Rick Scott had some big shoes to fill there. And I think he probably did by what I've heard from a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think people's ire is really directed toward the power companies now. So many people across the state, whether it was Jacksonville, Key West, Miami, St. Petersburg, they didn't have power. I personally didn't have power for 6 days. And I think people would drive around, especially on this side of the state in the Tampa Bay area, and see very little damage, maybe some trees or branches down, and say, why are we without power for 5, 6, 7 days? Why are we without internet? I think the utility companies will have a lot to answer for with this.
Yeah, that's definitely a major story that's going to come out of this hurricane. I know in Lakeland, my power was out 9 days. Like you said, there was a lot of trees down. Ramona Washington, executive editor of the Highlands News Sun, we were really glad to finally get in touch with you once you finally got power and were able to get back into your office.
Yeah, we've only been back here 3 days, but it feels good. It felt good to sit down at my desk and actually have room to work. So,
so what happened down in Highlands County in terms of power outages?
We were, I think, 85% without power. And we had power companies coming in from as far away as Canada, coming here and helping restore power. You know, we had a lot of problems with trees that came down on lines going directly to a house. We had meters that were broken, transformers, you know, that were blown that maybe took care of one or two houses. So some of these places where people across the street, people right next to them had power, it was very frustrating for some because they had individual problems. And those were the ones that were dealt with at the end. I think we had some that were without power for 11 and 12 days, but finally I think we've got everybody at 100%.
I wonder, is anybody hearing any discussions about changing the grid, burying more power lines, putting more state resources towards that?
Well, I know that's what all the residents are talking about. County commissioners, they've not brought that up yet. They've not started discussing it, but I'm sure that it's going to be something that will come up. You know, to go back and to bury all of the power lines, that would be the ideal situation, the ideal answer, but that would just be so costly. I don't know that that's something that they would do, but it is something that I'm sure will be discussed with our county commissioners.
Kate?
I've asked FP&L why haven't they buried more lines?
FP&L, that's Florida Power and Light.
Right. And the answer that I've consistently gotten is they're concerned about flooding, meaning that they're worried that if they buried the lines and there's flooding, like we saw, you know, in Jacksonville and in areas of South Florida as well, they say that if the power lines are underground and there's flooding, they're not going to be able to access them if they need to do that. And that flooding could potentially damage those underground lines, I think. But interestingly, so the Brickell area, which is sort of the financial area in downtown Miami, that had some really severe flooding. I mean, it looks like a river basically going down the street during the middle of the storm. And that area has a lot of buried lines, and they actually didn't lose power in a lot of cases. If they lost it at all, people in Brickell got their power back pretty quickly. So I personally still have questions for FP&L and, you know, utility providers here as to what extent does it endanger power lines if they're buried underground?
Tamara.
I think the issue of buried power lines, the grid overall, I think that's going to be the discussion pretty much over the next few months, if not the next year. Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran, he created a special legislative committee on hurricane response and preparedness, and he wants to make sure that Florida is even more prepared to weather the next storm. And he specifically mentioned hardening the grid and burying transmission lines as two areas that this committee will explore.
And hopefully put into state money, because if you've got a municipal, like Lakeland, it's municipal, Lakeland Electric, they're not going to have probably the money to do that. And maybe some state money coming towards that?
I think that's the question, and that's what they'll have to discuss.
Ramona Washington, could things really get any worse for the citrus industry? You know, it's been decimated by the bacterial disease, citrus greening, and now Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam has called the hurricane's effect on vegetable and citrus growers a major calamity. Tell us what's going on in Highlands County.
Well, we did receive quite a bit of damage here with our citrus, not nearly as much as what has happened over in some of the other counties, such as Polk. You know, what we are hearing here is that the citrus industry is not going to be anything like it, like what we are accustomed to. So, of course, this being a rural community, that's very alarming to us. We have citrus workers who right now are out of work because of the storm damage. We're hoping that, you know, they'll be able to get back to work soon. But it is devastating to our county here.
Tamara.
You know, 3 years ago, I did a story on citrus, a big story looking at citrus greening. And at the time, growers and people in the citrus industry were worried that someday, and someday soon, that greening would affect it so much that citrus would be a niche beverage like pomegranate juice. And I think that that is what the fear is now, that the hurricane has hit so much of the citrus industry. In Southwest Florida, some of the groves were underwater for days. Some of the roots were underwater for days. The bacteria also affects stress trees. So even the trees that survived the hurricane will be vulnerable to the citrus greening disease. So it's just one tragedy on top of another.
So in other words, if they weren't knocked down by wind, the water will rot the roots.
In some places, mm-hmm. Yes. I think in Southwest Florida, the groves down there, some of them, Adam Putnam told me that they were 90% destroyed. There was a little less damage, I think, in Central Florida, but still a lot of damage throughout the industry.
Yes. What we know is that last year already, the average grower here in Highlands County was producing about 40% of the crop that they had a decade ago. So that just goes to show you how much the citrus industry has suffered in the last 10 years even. And of course, when you have a devastating storm like what we had with Hurricane Irma, and of course we had, you know, the rainstorm that came right after the hurricane. I think that was like 4 days after the hurricane. There was like 5 inches of rain that was dumped here in Sebring. And so that additional water, you know, the ground is already saturated, and additional water on top of it just creates more issues. And how long will it take for it to finally dry up? We just don't know.
And citrus isn't the only crop that's been affected.
Citrus isn't the only crop. Avocados in South Florida, bell peppers. Adam Putnam told me that any fall crop that expected to be harvested by Thanksgiving probably would be affected. But the difference is that those people who grow bell peppers, for instance, they can replant and have another crop next year. That's not the case with citrus. You can't just plant another plant and have oranges next year. To plant a citrus tree, it takes about 4 or 5 years to produce the fruit. So this is going to be a really slow-moving disaster for the citrus industry, and this will probably be what I'll be focused on in terms of Irma as a reporter.
Tamara, is there some sort of financial aid from the state or the federal government that can help cover those losses and help them replant?
I know that the citrus growers that I've talked to are hoping that there will be some federal and state money to help them. And I think that the, you know, federal and state lawmakers are trying to do that. Whether or not they'll be able to or how much is the question.
You're listening to Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sussingham, and on our Reporters Roundtable today, we're joined by Tamara Lush, correspondent with the Associated Press. Joining us from Miami, Kate Stein, a reporter with NPR member station WLRN, and Ramona Washington, executive editor of Highlands News Sun in Sebring. We'll be right back. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sussingham, joined by reporters Tamara Lush with the Associated Press, Kate Stein with WLRN in Miami, and Ramona Washington, executive editor of the Highlands News Sun. Kate, we all tried to follow the path of this storm for days before it hit Florida. Remember, it was an emotional roller coaster, thinking, oh, it's going to stay way off the East Coast. No, I think it's going to hit the East Coast. No, now we think it's going to hit the West Coast and cause catastrophic flooding. How are people scoring the job that NOAA and the National Hurricane Center did in forecasting the path of the storm?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, NOAA and the National Hurricane Center, they issue these predictions with a lot of caveats. Like, we get these spaghetti models where they have 10 different tracks of the storm, and it's all, like, intertwined, and you've got kind of a mess of strings that show maybe one path heading to the West Coast and one to the East Coast and one right up the middle of Florida. And I think people were a little frustrated that they didn't know where exactly the storm was going to hit. But at the same time, when NOAA and the National Hurricane Center issue their predictions for storms, they typically give this thing called a cone of uncertainty, which is basically all of the possible regions that the storm could impact. And it's in the case of Hurricane Irma, it covered the entire state of Florida. So if you're going to evacuate, really, you should expect that the entire state could potentially be impacted by this storm. You shouldn't feel that, you know, just because you're leaving Miami, if the entire state of Florida is in the cone of uncertainty, then it's possible that even if you go to, say, Tampa on the other side of the state, you'll still be hit by this storm. And I think that message kind of didn't get across in the case of Hurricane Irma. And that's something that I think communication could be improved on for the next hurricane.
And later we started hearing you don't need to travel out of state. You don't need to use all the gas and go miles and miles and miles from your home. Go maybe a few miles away, stay in a hardened shelter that's out of the danger of flooding. And Kate, you took a look at some of those shelters, right?
I did, right. The shelters are intended to be places of last resort. And the reason for that, and this was very clear in the shelter that I stayed at for 3 nights, it's that the people who go to shelters, they're generally people of lower income, maybe elderly, people who have a harder time getting out or who maybe don't have the networks where they can evacuate to stay with friends and family. And so they're really relying pretty heavily on, say, the Red Cross or Miami-Dade or whatever county to provide things for them, you know, food and water. If you're elderly and you don't have a car, it's hard for you to take a case of water with you. And so the shelter that I was at, it was in a high school, Miami Edison Senior High School, which is on the border between Little Haiti and Liberty City, two of the lower income neighborhoods in Miami. And it was one of the more difficult experiences of my life, which I say as, you know, a 23-year-old, versus a lot of the elderly and homeless people who were there. And the reason for that is that it was just really difficult accommodations. You know, they didn't have cots, they didn't have blankets. So if you were 80 years old and had back problems and arthritis in your hips, you were sleeping on the floor the same as everyone else because the shelter was not equipped. I mean, I know that some shelters had some cots for people, but it was just very unclear which ones would have any sorts of resources and what people needed to be prepared to have with them, especially if you're not someone who is constantly checking the internet for news and updates from the county on what you should bring with you to a shelter. In basically when the storm was at its peak in Miami, a lot of people left the shelter. There was this sort of mass exodus, I think because it got to lunchtime and lunch was a slice of pizza and a bottle of water, and they told us to keep the water bottle. So supplies were running really low. And just because of that and the, you know, pretty terrible sleeping conditions, people decided to leave right in the middle of the storm. So there's going to be, if leaders want people to use these shelters and to see them as safe refuges during hurricanes, there really needs to be some improvements as far as accommodations or letting people know at least that, you know, we're not going to have cots for you.
Tamara,
You know, I didn't cover the shelter part of Hurricane Irma, but I did go to a shelter in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey in Houston. And it was an enormous shelter. It was downtown. And I will say that it was the best run shelter of any hurricane that I've covered. They had cots. They had blankets. Different countries even had little embassy tables for citizens to seek help from their home country, Guatemala, and Honduras and Mexico. They had tables for prayer resources. They had food. They had toys. They had a little play area for kids. It was really well run. I have to say that covering Hurricane Harvey was a different experience because people everywhere seemed remarkably organized.
And that was centralized as opposed to, you know, all the schools, little schools being used as shelters. You're certainly not going to have those kinds of resources.
I think that there were smaller shelters, too, but there were a few main really large shelters in very large convention centers or buildings. And it was very, very organized and running very smoothly as far as I could tell. And I was there probably a week after the main event. So, and I was pretty shocked, honestly.
Of course, a big difference is that it hit Houston as opposed to hitting the entire state, which is what we were dealing with here. Ramona Washington, there is a lot of poverty in Highlands County, right?
Yes, ma'am, we do. I mean, each community has its own little pockets that are pretty low income. We've had situations here where when they started school back up last Wednesday, some children were coming to school even with no shoes, where they had lost everything. And so the communities really come together. Habitat for Humanity Restore has opened up and is offering, as cases can be proven, they're giving appliances to those who couldn't afford to replace appliances if they lost them when the power was restored at their homes. We've had a parent or a grandparent, I guess, from out in Kansas who has sent clothes for children, backpacks, school supplies, you know, things to help get the kids back in school. So, we are very fortunate in that we help each other, but everybody's pulled together and are starting to get things back in order.
Tamara?
That's something I saw in Hurricane Harvey and here with Hurricane Irma, that people who rely on hourly wages, they're hit obviously disproportionately hard. I'm not even talking about the homeless, really poor people. I'm talking about, you know, middle income people who are living paycheck to paycheck. That was a real issue in Houston, and it's clearly a real issue here where people work in agriculture and work in tourism. People losing wages because they can't work or because they have to evacuate. I think it's also worth saying, and again, I don't mean to keep comparing Houston because it is one city, but Houston is a large sprawling city. I did see something there that I didn't see in Irma, that volunteers in Houston actually rented a warehouse or had a warehouse donated to them where people put all of their donations. This wasn't Red Cross. This was just people in the community. And it was everything from shoes to toiletries to furniture, and people who were affected could just come and get whatever they needed. And it was also a place where volunteers could sign up to volunteer to muck out homes. And I was really impressed by that. I was really impressed by the community and how, I keep saying organized, but how organized they were to help others in Houston in a very centralized way that I have not seen in Florida.
Ramona, was getting the donations to the people who needed them, is that a problem? Distribution seems like it's always a big problem.
Well, I know in the early days after the hurricane came through, the Highlands County Sheriff's Office started going door to door and checking on residents and making sure that everyone was okay. And in those cases where they found out that residents didn't have food and water, they were providing food and water for them. I mean, it was something where they went to the residents rather than waiting for the residents to come seek the help. Like I said, we've got the situation there with the Habitat for Humanity location. I know there have been some other locations where people can go and get things. I don't think it's so much of a problem now in the early days that it was, because we had so many streets that were blocked because of trees down. We still have some roads that are washed out, but I think people are getting the help that they need. The big thing for us in the beginning was ice and food. But all of our points of distribution have been shut down now, and I think everybody's starting to get back, you know, where they need to be.
For me personally, I know one story that I'd like to pursue is how the athletic facilities in the smaller rural schools were devastated, the batting cages and the soccer nets, and now they're really, it's hard for them to replace it. What kind of stories do you think you'll be working on next, Ramona?
I think that the citrus industry is one thing that we're going to have to continue. And it's not just the citrus, as was explained earlier. We've got a large dairy cow population here, you know, several dairy farms. We've got the blueberry farm. So, you know, there's different things agriculture related that we need to continue to stay on. We've also got a situation here where we had recently started curbside recycling, and that has been put on hold because there's so much debris out there that still needs to be picked up, and the recycling part of the landfill was damaged quite a bit. So, you know, there's things that we need to continue to watch and follow up with.
Tamara.
I think citrus was probably my answer to that. And I think that also we need to look at the sewer systems, too. I think the Orlando Sentinel had a story, it had a great story. And I think their headline was something like, Florida had a bath of sewage, which obviously is disgusting. But I think that there were a lot of sewage spills, and we need to find out why and how those can be prevented.
Right. The lift stations stopped working when the power went out. And so there were a lot of boil water notices, I know, around Polk County because of that. Mm-hmm. Kate?
I think just, you know, watching out for the elderly and vulnerable people, I think that there were a lot of issues with that. And part of that is communication. Like if someone is vulnerable at this point, if they don't have a smartphone or don't regularly check the internet, because that's how so much information is disseminated.
Amen to that. Without power, I called the power company and asked for an update. And she said, it's all on our Facebook page. Well, you know, I don't have power, as I explained.
Well, and I also think that people who were looking online and were listening to the radio and were watching TV when they did have power, once they evacuated, once they came back, I think they're at least on this side of the state in the Tampa Bay area where it was supposed to be this mega storm and then turned out to be very little, I think that people will think twice about evacuating, and that could prove dangerous in a truly large storm here.
Well, that's it for today's show. I want to thank the panelists who joined us for our first Florida Matters Reporters Roundtable. Tamara Lush, correspondent with the Associated Press, Kate Stein, reporter with WLRN Public Radio in Miami, and Ramona Washington, executive editor of the Highlands News Sun. Thank you all so much.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'd love to hear from you. What lessons have you learned from your experience during Hurricane Irma? You can share your thoughts on Facebook, or you can tweet us at Florida Matters, or email us, floridamatters@wusf.org. Our show is produced by Stephanie Colombini. Our engineer is Craig George. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sessingham. Thanks for listening.